Let's welcome our first speaker, Patrick A. from Asheville, North Carolina.
Hey, gang. My name is Patrick, and I'm an alcoholic. I know you guys do. All right. My sponsor. You guys remember the first speaker who hollered at us about chanting? Serena. My sponsor is her husband. So I was secretly excited that you guys almost didn't chant for me. But I do love to be loved whole bunches. So I'm an alcoholic. I definitely belong in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm... You know, sometimes, so the topic is sobriety. There's more to being sober than just putting the plug in the jug. So I'm kind of wondering why you guys are all here. You know what I mean? You guys have got to be working on some sobriety issues right now. And I'm wondering why in the hell I got picked for this baby, because I guess apparently... God or Sky Chief knows exactly what Sky Chief's doing. So I'll just share my experience with you. This is, my story is filled with a lot of relapse and a lot of long-term sobriety. And the common denominator in every time I've relapsed is that I stopped participating in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I became a dry drunk. I mean, that is the common denominator. There was nobody got, I didn't have anybody die in my family, and it was so painful I had to drink, and I didn't have any of that stuff. I became too good to participate in AA, and I became too full of self-will to think that I was somebody who would become too full of self-will to work the program, right? I mean, so anyways, I got sober for my very first time, close to 20 years ago, but in 1989, and close to 20 years ago, God, and I maintained sobriety. Eventually, I had about 3.5 years of sobriety. I went to treatment in 1991, and I got this sponsor, and he was tough, man. His name was Animal, and he was that guy. I mean, he sponsored the way his name would suggest that he would sponsor, and he was the kind of guy who would say, you know. Shut up and read the big book. And Alcoholics Anonymous comes from the book that's entitled Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're not doing Alcoholics Anonymous from the book called Alcoholics Anonymous and you're not working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, he was that guy. And I was 14, so I'm sure that sucked for him. So we took the big book and we read it through and through with a dictionary. And I read the big book and I called my sponsor and I went to 3 AA meetings a week. And I said the prayers, and I practiced, and I worked the steps, and that's what I did. And I stayed sober for 3.5 years, all through high school. I stayed sober doing that. And then what ended up happening was that I was going to this arts high school, and I was a musician, and I was playing music, and I was touring, I was traveling, and I was, young, and I was, I had a slip. Sobriety loses its priority. I had a slip. And that's what happened, man. I stopped going to AA meetings, and I stopped participating, and I thought it was more important for me to pursue the music stuff and be a high school student, So on my 18th birthday, I ended up relapsing after 3.5 years of sobriety. And, of course, I'm an alcoholic, gang, so it didn't really work out for me to drink. So I went back into AA after about close to a year of drinking alcoholically, and stuck around and got a new sponsor and read the big book and called him and worked the steps and prayed my ass off and all of that stuff. And I stayed sober for 5.5 years. And lo and behold, I stopped participating in Alcoholics Anonymous, stopped going to meetings, and I drank, I mean, that's how it goes for for me. I guess I want to qualify that too. I'm a big proponent of that people need to have their own experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want to say that my experience is going to be like yours, and if you haven't done it the way I did, then you're wrong. And I want to holler at meetings who like make people not share and take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth, jackass. You don't have anything to say. That's just really hard for me because I believe that that it's our job to be loving and patient and tolerant to anybody who comes into these rooms. So it's important for me to convey to you that this is just my experience, you know. So I ended up, I was in Mexico on some business award trip that I had won, and being all successful business award tripsmen, I decided to do ecstasy after 5.5 years of sobriety. And yeah, that's right. And I'm telling you, if you're going to go down, might as well be doing ecstasy in Mexico on the company's dime, you know what I mean? And boy, if you're also going to go down, I mean, I felt at that moment that I had it, and oh my God, I figured it out, you know? Because that's how you feel when you're on ecstasy until the next day rolls around. You know, I proceeded to drink and use alcoholically right away. And here's the crazy part. What that means for me to drink and use alcoholically, obviously, and maybe not obvious, maybe you're brand new to AA and you don't exactly know what we mean when we say alcoholically. That for me means that once I start drinking, even if I have an intention to not drink very much, I'm still going to not be able to stop. That's what I've got. That's what's broken about me physically. I can't stop drinking once I start, no matter how significant of a force of will I try to put into managing that situation. I'm unable to do that. But that's not what I identify with today as being an alcoholic. It is the thinking part for me. And what happens to me when I'm drinking, and I know this stuff about AA, is that I have to think my way out of being an alcoholic in order for it to be okay for me to drink alcoholically. Exactly. So I have to manage my drinking to my own self, to not drink alcoholically, because if I do that, then I probably should stop drinking, because then I would be an alcoholic. But I'm an alcoholic and I love to drink, so I better hell is not be drinking alcoholically, because if I did that, then I should probably stop drinking. I mean, that's the game, man. That's the game. That's what happens for my brain. That's what happens for me when I'm drinking. So I'm trying to process that, and I don't, and I get sober again for another couple of years, and then I end up being a musician, and I end up getting into this cool rock star band, and I'm traveling around the world and being a famous guy, and of course I should probably drink during this process too, and that of course failed because you know, that was the one thing I always held on to. It's like, well, what if that ever really happened to me, and blah 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 blah, and it did. And at the end of the day, that was not a cure for my alcoholism, being a famous rock star drummer breath. That did not work for me. And I ended up getting kicked out of that band for drinking too much. And I was destined to hit bottom. I didn't want to keep going through what I had been going through in Alcoholics Anonymous, which was that I was unwilling to actually do the work that it took to provide the spiritual experience that I needed to stop drinking alcoholically and thinking alcoholically and trying to manage my life. So I just drank myself nearly to death and lost everything. You know, the last, one of the last nights drinking, I was punching holes through my girlfriend's window in her house and running from the police, and I slept in the bushes, you know. And I've had accumulated about like 10 years of sobriety at this time. I mean, it's not who I am, you know, but it's who I become when I stop participating in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what that means to me is that I stop being a spiritual person. You know, I stop becoming somebody who is practicing spiritual principles, being useful and selfless and helpful to other people and thinking about goodwill throughout my day, as opposed to punching holes in my girlfriend's window and running through the police and thinking that I'm better than you because of a stupid band that I played in at one point in my life who kicked me out for being a drunk anyways. But I carry that stuff around with me when I'm not, you know, practicing this stuff. So anyways, hit bottom, and finally I was willing to actually go to those meetings that said, shut up, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth and wear a tie, and you don't know anything and you don't have anything to say. Because I was desperate, man. I was desperate. And it's what I needed. I would never go back to those meetings today, but it saved my ass. Because I was willing, and I ended up getting sober, and what happened is that I recognized that all of the options, man, I just ran out of all of the options that I thought would work in maybe saving my, you know, that would work for me, and I truly believed that I wasn't going to be able to solve this problem that I had by my own best thinking. You know, my broken head was not going to fix my broken head. I really recognized that, and I believed that to the core. So I participated in Alcoholics Anonymous fully, and I gave myself fully to AA, which I never wanted to do. I always thought that I wouldn't get to be the big rock star I wanted to be if I did that. So I didn't do that, and then I got to be the big rock star I wanted to be, and I'm an alcoholic. And I drank myself out of that, man. You know? So I realized that that was the deal, and I threw myself into AA. And when I mean threw myself in, I was like, oh, I moved to Hawaii, and I got a sponsor, and I didn't realize that this guy was actually the delegate for Hawaii. I didn't know what general service was, but I participated in general service, and I was like a GSR for my home group at like 9 months of sobriety or something like that, and I started to participate, and I was working the steps, and I was reaching out my hand, and I had a home group that I wouldn't miss no matter what, and I was reading the big book and calling my sponsor and doing everything that I knew works and helps stay sober. But that on top of, you know, I was the chair of Hickey Paw, and then I was this guy on Wacky Pod bid committee, and I just did it and did it and did it, and I was like levitating rocks. I was so spiritual with AA, you know, like, I mean, I bought, you know, I drank the Kool-Aid. It was like the first time I drank the Kool-Aid. It was the first time I really believed that if I really did this, that I would be relieved, and I was, and I, you know, and so what ended up happening was, I just moved. I moved about 6 months ago, and this is why this topic is so great for me to be sharing on. And the irony is that it wasn't anything that I did to, well, I'll get to that, but I moved. I wanted to be close to my family. I wanted to maybe build a little bit of a foundation, maybe work on a little egg nest, you know, and it's hard to do that in Hawaii when you're not from there. So I moved, and you know what? They don't do it as good as the people in Hawaii do. You know what I'm saying? And slowly, I had been over the last 6 months. I started to become full of self-pity. I started to become really upset at, you know, stupid little things, the way that they're not reading this, and they have this chip system, and I don't know if you guys know, but chips aren't a part of AA, and fuck you, you know, I mean, like, all of that stuff, man, like I now have become so Captain AA spiritual that it was actually starting to take my ass back out of the room. You give me the 5-minute card? Okay, good, because you guys know, I'll definitely go over that if I can. So I have been struggling big time because I think that I think that I know what's right, and I think that I know how AA should be, and don't you know that my sponsor was the delegate, right? That type of shit. And I was checking out. I mean, I had about a 2-month period where I went to like 2 meetings, maybe 3 meetings, and I wanted to drink really bad. It started to become really painful, you know, and what happens is that I don't think that we ever are cured, you know. I believe that we recover, but we recover from a bullet wound, and we're not bulletproof, you know. I can recover from that, but doesn't mean it's not going to happen to me. And so I was really, really struggling, and And then I got the call to speak on this panel. And I knew at that moment that I could actually sit up here all day long and talk about what I need to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, you guys know. You guys know. Read the fucking big book, man. Call your sponsor. Go to meetings. Pray to Sky Chief that you don't even know if you believe in. Right? But then what I experienced by getting this call at the particular moment that I did was God's grace. You know? That there are actually times where, regardless of how much AA spiritual rock levitation that I'm doing, that God just needs to come in and intervene. And so the minute that I got the call, I felt totally in my heart, I had better get my ass to a meeting. And I had better start participating back in Alcoholics Anonymous. And lo and behold, wouldn't you know it, I'm having a spiritual experience again. And I'm starting to have moments of acceptance about my current situation. And I don't want to drink alcohol, you know. I don't believe that I'm cured. Or that I had 5.5 years of sobriety before. I have that again, right? I have almost 6 years. And it's really, it is easy to, I mean, it says right in the big book, it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action. I mean, it really is. That's how we are. We're broke like that. Sometimes I think alcoholism should be called, I know exactly what I need to be doing that's good for me, thanks. But I'm not going to do it anyways because you don't understand, right? I mean, I know how to do this deal 20 years deep into AA, and still, at the end of the day, when I stop participating, I become sick in my soul because I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. That's what happens to me when I stop thinking about you guys. I don't believe that my spiritual relationship with the thing that helps me truly stay sober exists when I'm alone on a mountaintop being spiritual guy. It happens when I'm with you guys participating in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where God is for me. Good orderly direction, you know, group of drunks. That's my spiritual experience. And I don't get it when I don't show up. I don't get it when I don't show up. When I leave a meeting, I am always better. Always. Every single time, I'm better. Even if I suck, I just suck less. Or sometimes I'm moved to tears. I mean, when I come to, if you guys find yourself sitting next to me during the speaker, I'm crying the whole time. Seriously. Feeling it. Trusting it. Believing it. Like drinking the Kool-Aid, man. That's spiritual experience for me. That's AA. That's what keeps me from being the person who has continually failed outside of these rooms. And it wasn't you guys who convinced me that I would fail without you. I failed without you on my own accord and then came to you because I was broken. And you guys love me and hold my hand and show me how to get back to do this deal, you know? I mean, it's so powerful what we do here. It is so powerful what we do here. And we're crazy fucks. We are, the fact that we are the people who make this happen is wrong. It really is. And we do it. I mean, that to me is spirituality. That's what I can't get in the yoga class, man. Which, my mom's a yoga instructor, I'm down. But the spirituality that I find is because of my participation in AA. Being dry hurts. It really hurts. The isolation and the loneliness that we feel really hurts. And the truth is that we all feel that. And that's why we understand each other, you know? So I was very blessed, truly, the grace of Sky Chief to come here and to share on this. It's exactly what I needed at the exact right time. I mean, I was getting ready to check out again, gang. I really was. And now I get to be here to share that experience with you, and I don't want to do that anymore, you know? So Thanks for letting me share, and I hope you guys have a great conference. Thanks.
Let's welcome our second speaker, Dana C. from Davis, California.
Hi, I'm Dean. I'm an alcoholic. It really is an honor to be here, and thank you for what you said initially. And yeah, there's a lot more people than I thought there would be at a Sunday at 3 p.m. This far into the conference is like crash time. You know, if you've made it this far, good job. You know, it's these young people's conferences are really amazing. And every time I come to one, I'm just so blown away at how much work goes into it. And just like you were talking about, that a bunch of, you know, drunks who, you know, if you're like me, have absolutely no idea how to do anything that involves functioning in life. You know, I think it was like 3 years into my sobriety that I started opening my mail. You know, that's the kind of drunk that I was. And that's the kind of, you know, sober person that I was, and still am to an extent, you know. My sobriety date is February 29, 2004, and my home group is the Davis Young People's Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it meets on Friday nights, every Friday at 7, and, you know, my home group is actually a really big part of my sobriety and of me, you know, not having sobriety, which I didn't even know that was like a term. I'd heard dry drunk until I got asked to speak on this panel, which I was also sort of offended when my friend nominated me to speak on sobriety, and I was like, oh, I guess I don't work as good a program as I think I do. I'm getting nominated to talk on sobriety. So, yeah, but, you know, my home group is, you know, a really big part of me staying connected. And just a little bit about my story, qualify for you guys here. I actually went to my first AA meeting in the bottom of a hospital at Sequoia Union Hospital in Redwood City. I grew up on the peninsula, and then I went to UC Santa Barbara, and like was really excited because I thought that's where I was going to meet all my people, you know. And it turns out that like nobody at that school really drank like I did, which I was kind of shocked by. And I ended up needing to like get it together, and so I transferred to UC Davis, where I thought it was going to be like more serious, and you know, that was going to be able to really buckle down. And it turns out that I was just you know, same old Dean, a different place. And so what ended up happening for me was that I, you know, actually alcohol stopped working, which I think, I don't know, it doesn't get talked about a lot. Well, it gets talked about, but, you know, for me, that was like really the turning point, was that I just could no longer, you know, drink away my feelings anymore. Like, it just wasn't the solution that it had been my whole life. You know, and so I decided that, like, obviously without, you know, alcohol, and I didn't even realize, you know, obviously I was, like, still out there, so I didn't realize that that was my solution, right? But what, you know, I came up with was, well, this thing that always worked to, you know, help me feel the way I need to feel isn't working anymore, so I'm just going to try to kill myself. And so I was 5150 and only agreed to go to an AA meeting because I just wanted to get out of the psych ward, and there was like these people that were getting taken down to the basement, and I was like, yeah, how do I get on that train, you know? And they knew that, you know, my problems were alcohol related, and so I went down there, and what I heard was the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And at that point, you know, I had that desire. I spoke to my little brother, who's my best friend, and actually now has 5 years sober. And I spoke to him on the phone in the psych ward, and he said to me, "Don't you realize how hard my life would be without you in it?" And I hadn't like even considered what it would be like for him, you know, had my plans gone through. And that was like the first little sort of spark or spiritual awakening, I guess you could call it, that maybe my thinking wasn't as sane as I thought it was. You know, like maybe there was something a little wrong with the way I was looking at life. And so that gave me a desire to stop drinking because I recognized that, well, actually they told me that like if I didn't stop drinking, I had no chance of like getting better. And so I really wanted to try to, you know, and get well for him. And so I came back to Davis and I just started going to meetings because I had a desire to stop drinking. And I actually like didn't think I had to admit that I was an alcoholic because nowhere in the steps does it say, and we admitted we were alcoholics, you know. It just says like we said we were powerless over alcohol and had a desire to stop drinking. And so I was like, okay. And then the rest of the steps I didn't really, I was pretty out of it when I got here and I did not put two and two together, you know. And sometimes I joke that like if I'd known what I was gonna have to do, I might not have stuck around. But fortunately for me, my experience was that like I just, you know, it was just one day at a time, and I seriously just had no clue what was going on like 99% of the time. And so I, you know, just started going to meetings, and you know, for me, I stayed really plugged in. Actually, it was the second meeting I ever went to, it was my home group. And it was a business meeting, and there was a girl there who I used to drink with like years before. And then, of course, you know the story of what happened to her. She disappeared, and then I show up today, and there she is. And she's like, "Come to the business meeting." And so she nominated me to be coffee person. So I got a coffee commitment, and I had no idea that like you couldn't not show up for your commitment, right? Like I didn't know what I thought happened, but it seemed like a big deal. And so I did that commitment like every week for a year, you know, and just. And that was just my experience, and I've always, always, always had a service commitment at my home group. And the other thing that I do is I go to the business meeting at my home group. And believe me, it's Friday night, you know what I mean? It's 9 o'clock at night. It's the last place I want to be. We're all starving. It's an AA business meeting, which if you've been to one, you know they're kind of a pain in the butt. But, you know, I show up to that business meeting, and I am of service to my group. And as far as, anyway, so talking a little bit about the sobriety aspect, what happened to me was about a year in, it was right around, after my year birthday where I sort of realized that, like, I'd been looking at all this stuff that I needed to do, like, I need to work on all these issues over here and, you know, this, and I'm, like, slowly getting better. And when I turned a year, a couple things happened. One was I realized that like this stuff that I was looking at that I knew I needed to work on, I realized that that was just like the tip of the iceberg. And like icebergs are what, like 70% that's still below the surface, you know what I mean? And so I had like just really, I think a layer of the onion peeled away and I was sort of overwhelmed by how much more I still had to do. Because I guess I thought like, oh, at a year you really have your shit together, you know? Especially as a young person, it seems like forever when you come in here, right? 1 year sober and here I am at 7 years sober and still issues to be worked on and character defects to get better at, you know, not practicing or engaging in. But, and so that happened. And then, of course, there was a boy and, you know, AA girl meets boy on AA campus and that didn't work out. And so I become sort of like disillusioned with AA. And what happened for me was it only took me 1 month fortunately, like I said, I had a sort of service commitment. So I went to my service commitment once a week, and the rest of the time I was a waitress. I worked at night at this like bar restaurant. I went to that job and I slept all day, and when I got up, I watched Lost and I fantasized about being an extra on the show, and that was going to be like my new solution. And I just barely went, you know, and I just like dreaded going to that AA meeting all week. And it took about 1 month before I woke up and was like, this is the day I'm either going to like kill myself or I'm going to start going back to AA and like really doing the deal. And that's what I did. And I, you know, went back, I started going to the 6:30 AM meeting in my hometown the town that I live in. And I just like got on fire for AA after that, sort of like he was talking about, you know, and just really got involved, started going to, I don't think I did 90 and 90, but I did 90 and 90 at that point. And I had actually worked the steps. And so I was looking for a sponsee. And that was the other thing that had happened in the first year I worked the steps. And I got a sponsee at that point, you know, and it came along when I actually had something to give, right? Like we can't give away what we do not have or whatever. So I got a sponsee, and that was like one of the most profound spiritual experiences that I've had in this program. I took her all the way through the steps, which I think is a pretty rare thing. And that fourth step, like listening to her fourth step, is where I just absolutely felt kind of all the promises in the ninth step come true. You know, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity will slip away. I will see how my experience can benefit others. Really that magic of like one alcoholic talking to another that was also touched on. You know, we get here, but I don't get sitting up on a mountaintop, like, you know, praying to Buddha or whatever, you know. That really like AA is, you know, for me, what keeps the insanity away. And so I stayed involved for a really long time. I was involved in young people's, and you know, I went to a lot of meetings, and I lived with sober people, and there were like people crashing on my couch, and we had like the sober party house for a really long time, and it was just like I've had so much fun being sober and going around to, you know, stuff like this, young people's conferences, and just really staying involved in. I always used to say that, like, if you're not happy, joyous, and free, you know, you're doing something wrong. And I've since, like, come to realize that life happens and that, you know, we're not always going to be happy, joyous, and free all the time in here. But, you know, what I try to look out for is, you know, being restless, irritable, and discontented. Because no matter what's going on in my life, if it's, you know, a death of a loved one or, you know, someone having some, you know, other severe health problems or personal problems, just, you know, life stuff. If I'm, you know, restless, irritable, and discontent around that stuff, then, you know, there's something more I need to be doing in my program. And what's going on for me in my life right now, and it's interesting because I didn't think, you know, I really like what he said about me being asked to speak on this panel is you know, part of my higher power's plan. And I am, I wouldn't say that I'm going through a period of like sobriety, but what's going on for me is I'm sort of transitioning from like young people AA being fired up all the time, you know, to sort of like more domestic life, I guess. And I live with my boyfriend who's a normie. And it's real easy for me to just slip into that life and to just go to less meetings and not, you know, work as diligent a program and make that relationship my higher power, you know. And so, you know, I was actually talking to my sponsor about, it's an interesting thing that I think happens when you get young, because when you, obviously this isn't my, I don't know, but from what I can tell, like when you're already have a family and you're married and you're, you know, later on in life and you get sober, you sort of like know how to balance all that stuff. And for me, you know, transitioning to like kind of doing AA all the time to like having this sort of other life that's not, you know, revolving around AA. And I've seen, you know, a lot of my friends who have got married and have kids, like that's a big struggle to try to stay plugged in, right, when you have that going on in your life. And so, you know, for me, it's just a good reminder to be here and to realize, just like you said, like, it's one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic that's keeping me sober. You know, it's me coming to meetings, hearing another alcoholic speak, and then also continuing to work with my sponsees and really like making time for that in my life. And that's another thing that, you know, I've always done is I've always had sponsees. And it's just a big part of my story. I always go talk to the newcomer at my home group, and that's how I get sponsees. People are like, oh, where do I find, you know, I can't find a sponsee. And it's like, well, really? There's like tons of newcomers everywhere. And, you know, and it's not about me keeping another woman sober. It's about me staying sober. And it really is, you know, kind of selfish. Like, I heard a guy say, probably when I was about 5 years sober, that, and it was at a big speaker meeting, like, it may have even been at an ACIPA, but he said, you know, for every single person that's in their first 30 days in this room, there's that many people in their last 30 days. And that just, like, really kind of shook me to my core, you know, and I really think about, like, am I doing what I need to do to make sure that I'm not in my last 30 days of sobriety? And, you know, I've been sober for long enough to see a lot of people that I'm close to go out, and a couple people, you know, one with double-digit sobriety, like, go out and within 6 months be dead. And that, you know, really scares me. And, you know, and so sobriety is the first step on my way to having a drink, you know. My first sponsor always used to say, the relapse starts way before it actually happens. But it definitely is. You know, it's easy for me to just rest on my laurels. It's easy for me to, like, just last night I couldn't sleep, and I was really pissed off at this thing that happened in my home group on Friday. I got in an argument with one of the other members about something, and I was still, and, like, I usually don't get this angry, but I was so mad at, like, still last night that I, like, couldn't sleep, and I realized I hadn't done my prayer meditation last night. And so I, like, got out of bed and, like, went to go do my prayer meditation, and I said the Lord's Prayer, and it says, you know, like, basically talks about forgiveness, and, you know, that it is only, like, forgiving that we ourselves are forgiven, you know, and also the part about, you know, let me bring, like, love where there's hate, basically. And so I was thinking about those two things, and I was like, damn it, I have to forgive this person, you know, and, like, I really just wanted to, like, stay pissed off, because I think that I'm right, you know, that self-righteous anger, but, and, you know, and that's, like, the way my brain works, that, like, my default is just to think that I'm right all the time and run on self-will and think that I don't need to, you know, ever admit that I'm wrong or work on any character defects or forgive people or, you know, any of that stuff. And I did a little prayer meditation before I came to speak here because I want to, I mean, there's a lot to talk about. I mean, the first step is the only one that even mentions alcohol, right? So there's, like, 11 other steps to talk about when we're talking about, you know, sobriety is more than just not drinking. And so it's a lot to cover. And anyway, so I did some prayer meditation, and then I opened up the big book as sort of like something to focus on and what, you know, maybe what I can say that will be helpful. And I opened it up to this part in working with others, which also talks about practicing the principles in all our affairs, which is the second half of the 12 step. And for me, that's a big part of not being dry. You know, like, if I want to be a good example of a good example and not a good example of a bad example, I need to try to be practicing these principles in all my affairs. And anyway, and so I opened it to this part, and the first thing I read was, argument and fault-finding are to be avoided like the plague. In many homes, this is a difficult thing to do, but it must be done if any results are expected. And, you know, and that's just so, I mean, avoided like the plague. Like, that doesn't really give me any wiggle room, you know what I mean, to think that I'm right or to argue with other people or to have that, you know, just self-righteous anger. And then it says, the next part that I read, and it's just like one little sentence, is that, you know, basically, we alcoholics continue to demonstrate that we can be sober, considerate, and helpful, regardless of what anyone says or does. And, you know, like, I don't know how many times I've read the big book, but I thankfully don't have it memorized. And so I, you know, it's just amazing to me, you know, how this program works, how my higher power works, you know, and that I can open it up to any page in the big book and read exactly what I need to read for what's going on in my life right now. But I don't open this book, like, left to my own devices. You know what I mean? If I'm not, like, going to meetings, talking to other alcoholics, working with my sponsees especially, I don't open up the big book. You know, I just sort of, like, go along my normal way and, you know, get pissed off at people who are, like, counting out change when I'm trying to, you know, buy a loaf of bread at the grocery store. Like, who does this old lady think she is? I mean, that's sort of like, you know, still how my brain works. And then, you know, I mean, and, like, left with all those feelings, inevitably, you know, my next thought is going to be a beer sounds really good, you know, and then who know, you know, we all know what the next step is from that. I can only have those cravings for so long before I decide to pick up a drink. And so, yeah, you know, one of the guys in my in my home group said, you know, I was sort of, I had gone on this cruise to Mexico with my family, and I think when things are going bad for me in this program, I stick really close to home. You know, I'm going to lots of meetings, I'm calling people, I'm talking to people, but it's when things are going really good that, like, that's when I'm resting on my laurels, you know? And so I was on this cruise and wasn't going to meetings, even though there probably were some. I didn't even bother because I was with my family and they're all normies, and except for my brother. Anyway, a glass of wine started looking really good. And not only does it looking really good, but I started having those thoughts of, like, how come they get to drink and I don't? You know what I mean? Like, that, those self-pity, like, what the hell? You know, like, this, you know, this isn't fair. Pour me a drink, that kind of thing. And so, you know, and I came back and I immediately shared about it at my home group. And one of the members said to me, you know, yeah, people say a lot of, you know, that our disease is, like, in the parking lot doing push-ups. And he says, I think my disease is in the parking lot doing calculus. I think it's actually, like, getting smarter, you know, like, the more time I get to find, like, exactly where that weak spot is going to be. And it just is patient and waits. And, you know, and so that's what I look out for today. You know, I don't ever want to be in my last 30 days of sobriety. And so I'm making sure, hopefully, you know, that, that I'm doing what I need to do today to not be dry, to practice all the principles of my affairs, and to avoid that restless, irritable, and discontentedness, you know, and to really, like, be watching out for that. And fortunately, there's always a meeting wherever I go if that comes up, you know, and there's another alcoholic's only a phone call away. So I feel really fortunate to be asked to talk, and that you guys all didn't have a nap and came out so that I had someone to speak to and could remind myself how to stay sober and not dry. Thank you.
Let's welcome our third speaker, Michael R. from Oakland, California.
Thanks, Jose. My name is Michael, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Michael. Hey, Michael.
Thanks for the coffee, Leanne. I'm completely wired. I can do this in 5 minutes. I, too, wondered why I was asked to speak at a young people's conference, first of all, and this topic, second of all. My paranoia was that I was the only person old enough, they thought, to understand the phrase, plug in the jug. For the record, I never drank out of a jug. A lot of other things, but not a jug. A lot of the other anachronisms in the book were anachronisms even for me. I never knowingly attended a plain, ordinary whoopee party. And I have never called my wife Ma, as in, ain't it grand, the wind stopped blowing. That aside, it's an important topic. Two stories came to mind thinking about this. And it's funny, I think what I'm going to end up talking about is a conversation that my friend Steve and I had directly before this meeting. But two stories came to mind. The first was, you know, there's no place like your home group, you know, where you get sober. And my home group was in Los Angeles, and it was a men's meeting. It was a big, rowdy group of guys, and they allowed cross-talking. And it scares me even today to think about it. But I remember this guy got up one day, and his share went something like this. He said, I woke up pissed this morning. I yelled at my wife for no good reason. I got in the car. I cut off a couple people. I flipped off a few others. Went to work. I didn't do shit. Cheated on my expense account. Came home. Didn't yell at my wife, but yelled at my kids, kicked the dog. But at least I'm standing here today sober, which I thought was pretty good. I was new. I thought that was quite an achievement. Back of the room, this old-timer bellows, yeah, you're a sober prick. Which, you know, that's not the kind of sobriety I want. I don't want to be able to stand up here today and say, you know, I'm just sober. That's all I am, is sober. The second story is more personal, and you know, I'll tell a little bit of my story to get there. I was a relapser. It took me a long time to put together any amount of time. You know, I was one of those guys whose hand was raised for so long, this old guy called me the Statue of Liberty. And it was sort of permanently like that. And And like the other two speakers shared, I mean, when something happened, something happened. I mean, I conceded to my innermost self, and I threw myself into this program, and, you know, I did what I was told. And I experienced amazing things. My life, I mean, nothing didn't change. Nothing didn't change in my life. You know, the bedevilments, the promises, the bedevilments. Bedevilments mean a lot to me because it captures at best. You know, my personal relationships were restored, and you know, my emotional nature was different, and I could make a living, and you know, those things happened for me, and time went on, and I think you know, you described it well, Dina. I mean, what happens is we get things, you know, and we have to start balancing this thing called sobriety with the rest of our life, and it's not easy to do with family and with school and careers and what have you. And I stayed real close for about 5 years, and then I got that dream job. And the dream job took me about 400 miles away from my home group and my sponsor, and you know, it was this insidious little thing that happens. I mean, The 6-7 meetings a week went down to 5, and then to 4, and then to 2, and then to 1. And, you know, the calls to the sponsor, which were long-distance calls, and I'm sober long enough that we didn't have free minutes, you know, that was long distance. And so those started, you know, dwindling. And, you know, and most of all, it was God, you know, for me. I checked in with God, but it was more like a casual acquaintance and not a deepening relationship. And, you know, to speed up the story, thanks to Leanne's coffee, I was about 10 years sober. And I can honestly tell you that drinking was the last thing on my mind. I did not, you know, there was no obsession to use, there was no thought, there was no romancing it, but I went to a meeting. It was a Sunday morning meeting, and it was a fairly small group, and everybody shared, and we went around, and I was the second to the last person to share, and it all just came out. It all just, I mean, it was one of those horrible vomit shares that you hear, and you just cringe, and oh my God, that poor guy. And the last guy to share was a new guy. He had less than 30 days, and he shared, and the meeting was over, and we did the prayer, and it was over, and everybody, of course, rushed up to the new guy to give them their phone numbers and offer their help, and he just sort of said, "Hey, I'm fine, but that guy," pointing to me, "he needs help." And I did. I mean, you know, we got to remember that the alcoholic still suffering sometimes is the guy with 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. And the reason he's still suffering is because he's moved so far away from the program. You know, Bill writes about this. I mean, he wrote about it probably 20 years later. I can't remember. It's called Emotional Sobriety. And you know, I think he captures it really well. I mean, he talks first about sort of the adolescence in all of us, you know, and for those of you who are still adolescent, that's probably hard to imagine. But, you know, he talks about, you know, we still have these very childish reactions to the world, and I did. And he goes on to talk about his own depression, which he suffered from, and he talks about, you know, the root of that to him was that he had moved dependencies to all the wrong things. And that's what had happened to me. You know, the promises had come true, the bedevilments had started to go away a little bit, and I was starting to depend on everything, all the wrong things. I was depending on that relationship, which had been restored to me, and I was depending on a career that was taking off, you know, like yours. I mean, it was taking off, and that became more important. And it wasn't just that it was more important than meetings, and it wasn't that it was just more important than sponsorship, but it was becoming more important than God. And that's really what I want to talk about, is that, you know, this thing for me is, what is the point? I mean, the point is not to drink and use, obviously, but the point, after you've had this spiritual awakening in the 12 step, and after you've started practicing these principles in all of our affairs, I mean, what is the point? Just continuing to do that? That's not been my experience. You know, in that men's stag meeting down in LA where I got sober, we were told, you know, the steps are like a clock, and once you get to 12, then it goes back to 1, and you just redo this thing again and again, and you go deeper and you go deeper and you go deeper, and the thing that you need to go deepest with is your relationship with a higher power. And, you know, I think about that when, you know, Bill talks about dependencies. I mean, I think one of my dependencies was that I was highly dependent on really a lot of old ideas. The ideas that helped me get sober and helped me stay sober those first few years. See the coffee. But I was still using the same higher power. I was still using that same conception of the higher power, and it had not grown. I had not deepened that relationship. Now, I wish I could tell you that incident I told you at 10 years changed everything, and I'm a little over 25 years sober today. That has not been my experience. I am one of those guys, I learn really slowly. I have to make the same mistake over and over again. And I have moved a lot in sobriety, and every time I have moved, I have repeated that same pattern, you know, that insidious sort of stepping away and just making it a little more casual and getting busy with other things and depending on all the wrong things. And, you know, it took me hitting another bottom. It was about 18 years sober, and let me tell you the story. I walked into a book study, This is my original big book. It's got the watermark from when I used it as a coaster when I wasn't quite done yet. But I've thoroughly read this thing. I mean, I have thoroughly marked up this thing. And I was from, you know, a school of sobriety where you carried this to every meeting you went to and you underlined things that were important. And if you weren't underlining, somebody elbowed you and said, "That's important," you know. You got bored, you underlined to stay awake, but it's thoroughly underlined. I have thoroughly read this book a number of times, and I'm at this book study, and they're reading a story, and it's an unfamiliar story to me. I've never heard this story, which is odd, because I have read this thing, and what I realized is that we were reading from the fourth edition, and I've got a third edition, and the story went something like this. It said, I can't remember the name of the story. Gutter Bravado, I think it is. And the guy says he's new and he's impatient for the rewards of sobriety. He wants it to all happen really quickly. And so he walks up to this guy with some time and talks about how much he envies his time and his experience. And the guy slams down his hand on the table and says, "Okay, I'll trade your time 30 days with my 30 years, even Stephen." Because as the story goes, what the old timer knew that the newcomer couldn't know is that it's the journey, not the destination. And what had happened to me is I had arrived at a destination. And it was a comfortable place, and I wasn't going to drink. But I was deeply unhappy. I was deeply disconnected with a higher power. And, you know, that's not the point of this thing. I mean, it is a journey, and it needs to continue, and it needs to deepen. And so, as a result of that meeting, as a result of that day, a result of that experience, I went out and I bought a brand new big book, and I started all over. I started all over, and I started with a preface, and I started underlining anew. So what did this stuff mean to me now? You know, not just what, you know, I knew what it meant to me when I got sober the first time, but what did it mean to me now? What did it mean to read Bill's story with some time? And what did it mean to the first step and the second step? I mean, it's a different experience. I quote all the time the set-aside prayer, which I believe we have stolen from NA, but it is a prayer that has saved my life. You know, what it says is, "God, please set aside everything I think I know about AA, the steps, and especially about you. Give me the willingness and the open-mindedness to have entirely new experience with those things." And that, I think, is sort of the key here. If I am to stay emotionally sober, if I am to be able to experience this thing again and on a deeper level, I have to be open-minded and willing to experience this in a different way than I have before, and that includes my relationship with a higher power. I want to read what a passage that sort of means the most to me today, and which sort of sums up, I think, what I'm now striving for. And again, it's one of those passages that was thoroughly underlined, but I don't think I understood it until very recently. It's the penultimate paragraph in the 12 step in the 12 on 12 in the longest run-on sentence ever written. Service gladly rendered, obligations squarely met, troubles well accepted or solved with God's help. The knowledge that at home or in the world outside we are partners in a common effort. The well understood fact that in God's sight all human beings are important. The proof that love freely given surely brings a full return. The certainty that we are no longer isolated and alone in a self-constructed prison. The surety that we need no longer be square pegs in round holes, but can fit and belong in God's scheme of things. These are the permanent and legitimate satisfactions of right living for which no amount of pomp and circumstance, no heap of material possessions could possibly be substitutes. I was a big pomp and circumstance guy. I was a big material guy. Then it goes on, true ambition is not what we thought it was. True ambition is the deep desire to live usefully and walk humbly under the grace of God. And that to me is what I want. You know, I thought I wanted a lot of different things. I thought I got sober for a lot of reasons. I got sober to save my marriage. I got sober to save my job and to advance in my career. But, you know, with time and with my experience, I have come to realize that, you know, this is what I want. This is what I want. It's much more simple than I ever thought it would be. And I just want to continue to grow, continue to know myself better than I did, and to know God better than I have. You know, it's been an amazing experience for me, and I'll close with this. In another piece of our literature, which isn't widely read, AA Comes of Age, in the appendix, this guy, Dr. Harry Thibault, writes, and he says, you know, AA can't be just a single miracle. And I had coasted on my single miracle for about 10 years. And what I have found is that I need more miracles in sobriety. And if I do this thing, then I get to experience those miracles. You know, there's so many paradoxes in this program. I have no idea how this thing works. I have no idea. But, you know, I mean, one of the things is just the 12 step, which Dina talked about, you know, being of service and practicing these principles in our affairs. I mean, I think one of the paradoxes is, why do I do all this stuff, all this inventory work and the amends? And, well, I do that stuff so that I can help others. And then I help others. And in the process of helping others, I end up helping myself some more. So, you know, the spirit of constant service is really what needs to guide me today. And anyway, I'm going to close there, and I thank you very, very much for having me, and have a great conference.